is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, consultants, and extension agents. In this series, you're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hi there, and so glad you could join this episode of the Soil Sense podcast. My name is Tim Hammerich, and through this series, we are capturing the collaboration that's happening in North Dakota among farmers, researchers, consultants, and extension agents to improve soil health. If you haven't done so already, I highly encourage you to listen to the first three episodes in the series. You're especially going to want to listen to episode three, which is the first installment of the interview you're going to hear today. We have back on the show Dr. Dave Franson, a soil scientist with the North Dakota State University Extension, and farmer Anthony Tillamoni, who has been cooperating with Dr. Franson for over 20 years. The last episode emphasized the importance of soil fertility and some of the advancements in that field from both a scientific and a practical perspective. Today, Dr. Dave and Anthony are going to discuss more about the precision side of soil health. How does a farmer, for example, make sure that they know the fertility needs of every aspect of their field? And once they understand those needs, how can they adapt their farming practices accordingly? There have been some tremendous technological advancements to make all of this possible and change some of the old ways of thinking when it comes to things like sampling, fertility, and management. Listen as Dr. Franson describes an early aha moment he had.
I had a specialty coming out of Illinois in site-specific nutrient management and grid sampling, and so that was really the study I'd started here. And changed my whole perspective. It's just south of where we're sitting here, just south of the lots of 40 acres we carved out of the field and sampled it at a quarter acre grid, roughly. And I had a cool nitrate pattern at the end of the year that I mapped out, and it kind of looked like a horse head in the middle of it, and I thought, that's cute. I'll never see that again, because my teachers would tell you that you can test for nitrate, but it'll be different the next year, and you shouldn't expect it to be in the same place, blah, blah, blah. And so I sampled it the same way the next year, and I mapped it out, and there was a horse head, and it changed my whole perspective, because the only reason that was there is there's some logical reason for it to there, and that was really the start of the zone sampling. So it was there because of the topography. The horse head was in the swales in between the ridges. It's there because that's the way water moves, and nitrate moves with the water and collects. And the alternative, really, you know, when I started it out, I thought, I'm going to do this for a few years. People are going to find out it takes a sample an acre grid in order to identify patterns in the field, and it's going to be way too expensive, which it is. And that'll be it, and because everybody always told me that precision farming wouldn't work in North Dakota; it'd be too expensive, blah blah. So when we found out that the zone sample, to dividing the field into maybe three, four, five different areas, mostly based on landscape and supported by other data, that it changed everything. It made it economic for people to do it, and it started right here.
And when Dr. Franson says it all started right here, he means right there at Aunt Anthony Tillamoni's farm. We were sitting in Anthony's shop having this conversation. And now you might think that revelation about zone sampling would lead to the natural conclusion that, oh, we can identify the underperforming areas and get them performing better so they can keep up with the better areas. Well, as Anthony will tell you, that's not really the case.
One thing Dr. Dave and I have talked about, originally when he started his work and I started farming, the idea was, okay, we're going to go out here, these bad areas, we're going to make them yield as good as the good areas. That was, you know, we're going to go. We beat our head against the wall a couple, two, 3 years, and we finally determined the bad areas are bad and it's not fixable. So now we go look at the good areas. Well, we're way under yielding because we weren't fertilizing heavy. We were blanket raiding. You know, so you weren't putting enough fertilizer on, you weren't doing things right. So because of his work and his efforts and the way he looked at it, I've slowly migrated into the variable rate fertilizer applications, which has left variable rate seeding and spraying and everything else. But I started on that, and what I'm doing now is I'm feeding the good ground. The ground that doesn't yield, you put a base rate on or whatever. And my dad, I wish he was here, he could tell you, because he sits in the combine and shakes his head and said, I don't know where you get this yield from. You know, you're getting half again, double the yield we used to, and you're not using any more fertilizer. I'm using about the same amount of fertilizer, but I'm putting it in the right spots. And it's changed the perspective. I look at things quite different because of that, you know, and management. Now, that doesn't mean, like I said, we're putting some tile in. There might be bad areas in the field right now that I'm not yielding to its potential, but there was a problem. I fixed the problem, but it might take a few years for the soil health and everything to come around to become a lot more productive. Some of it has changed in 3 years dramatically, you know. But there are other bad areas that sand, whatever, it just, there's no fix. I can't fix what the problem is, so.
It's really hard in these sandy hills that were eroded many years ago, and they have hardly any organic matter at all, and they have no, the sands just don't stick together. Any little wind, I mean, you've tried to put manure on some of those, but the dirt blows off the neighbors and it blows the manure off. So there you are. So some of those areas, it's just best to not put a lot of inputs in it. Just put in the minimum and accept it.
It definitely makes sense after you hear Anthony and Dr. Franzen talk about it that this variable rate fertilization application would allow for you to put the fertilizer in the right spots where the crop is going to most benefit from it. But I'm sure that there still are quite a few producers out there not quite embracing this new technology, and there had to be reasons. So I asked Dr. Franzen and Anthony both, you know, what do you think the reason is more farmers don't adopt some of these precision technologies for the betterment of their soil and of their operation?
Well, this is a very conservative state, and it is because of, what do you call it, natural selection? Except for potato country and maybe a little bit in sugar beet country. Farmers that are around today and were around 25 years ago were there because they watched the pennies, and they didn't do anything outlandish. And it was acceptable for people that came before me that farmers would just soil test. And by soil test, they would go out into, say, a quarter section of land, and the person doing the sampling would kind of select the area that most represented the field, and then take a number of samples from that, put them in a bucket, take a sample out, and then that would be the sample that you gave to the lab. So all you had is one number to represent a field. I think the reason it took hold first in Illinois and maybe a couple of the other I states is because the tradition in Illinois was to sample on a 2.5 acre grid. I mean, this is even before site specific. And then see the numbers and then average the numbers and use the average number in order to direct your soil test. So farmers already had a good indication that there was variability out there. And, you know, some of them would comment from time to time, and I couldn't help but wonder, too, I wonder what would happen if we could manage each of these little 2.5 acre places different. But they had no history of that here. And so the work that I did was really pretty radical. You know, the zone sampling concept is the number one site-specific nutrient management strategy in the state. I wish more people would do it. I think the lack of independent crop consultants probably holds it back some. And then springs like this, when you're just lucky to have the fertilizer on the field in any way in the world, sometimes that holds it back to the practical application of those kind of technologies. You need a little bit more time to get everything together and go and not worry about, you know, am I going to get the fertilizer? When are they going to get here? All those kind of logistical things.
One thing off of what Dr. Dave was talking about with the conservative nature, I've made a big point of telling a lot of people when I started with the Precision Ag, the first couple of years, I manually controlled my Raven in the cab. That was my first precision farming fertilizer app. Luckily, unluckily, whatever, I've been able to do all of this with generally old equipment. My newest tractor is an 8650. I've wired in all the new harnesses, put all the technology into old equipment, and do it. Because I've done that, I was able to do it piecemeal. I had a goal. I didn't go from here to there. You know, I went five steps in between. I couldn't imagine at this point, if somebody come to me and wanted to do what I'm doing right now, what it would actually cost in 1 year to set up to do everything I've done. Everything I've done has been over 15 years. So the conservative nature, I didn't ever go out. I think the biggest amount I ever put out at one time would have been this last purchase, the sprayer. To have the Hawkeye so I can do variable rate with my sprayer. And that would have, was 50, 60,000. Most of the time I was less than 15,000 in my steps to do it. And that's a big thing. People say, well, I can't buy new equipment. You don't need new equipment.
Anthony's 15 years of really watching his expenses by slowly adopting new technology and acquiring new equipment got me curious about which of the pieces of equipment or technology have had the most dramatic of an impact on the way he farms.
It would be between either the sprayer or the seeding implement. The sprayer, probably not so much soil health, but that's what made no-till possible, is having the equipment to spray. But over the years, my dad started with Haybuster 107s, and they worked and did the job. Then we went through the typical deal. It got hard, and he had hard times with hair pinning, couldn't get penetration. So he flipped over to the Flexicoil with Eagle Beaks, basically a hose style, and we no-tilled for 20 years with that. Well, things changed for me. The soils, when I started really changing, and I ended up getting rid of the Flexicoil and going to the 1890. And it was a good change. There are times I still wish I had a tooth opener for certain situations, but I mean, so you cycle through and you progress with things depending on what's available and as conditions change. What I've ended up with, one of the reasons I needed to get rid of the Flexicoil, is my moisture conservation has been so good, and we're into wetter years. The tooth wasn't a good feature. It would bring wet soil up and it would stick on my packer wheels and I'd have problems. I can go in with the 1890. The problem is I can seed way too wet a soil. Then I sidewall compact. So I've had to learn to be patient. Even though I can go across the field, the surface is dry, the field isn't ready to seed. Right. So there, everything's a learning experience and that. And this year was really aggravating because of that. You know, we're 3 weeks later than we should be, 4 weeks later. You want to go out and seed, the surface is dry, and I go out and dig down in, and I better not seed this. This is too wet, you know. And yet you want to go.
This issue of having to be patient because it was too wet is something I've sort of heard as a criticism of no-till agriculture, that in really wet years, it becomes a problem. You retain too much moisture. And so I wondered with Anthony if he'd experienced any problems with getting out in the field based on the way he farms.
I get out as earlier than anybody else now. I think my infiltration is incredible. Actually, the last 2 years, we've started installing tile because I have seeps showing up where we've never had saline seeps. And I completely blame it on the fact that no-till, the rain comes, and instead of running off the field, it soaks in and then goes horizontally. And if I don't use it with corn or sunflowers or, you know, a deep-rooted crop, then I have these problems. So we've started installing some tile in fields. And everybody tells me no-till's too wet, you can't seed. I'm out before anybody else is seeding.
Yeah, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, we had kind of a wet spring and you were seeding something and you gave me a call and said, you know, I'm going across this hill and every little gopher hole, there's this geyser that comes up as my seeder comes up. So it's drying up the plant, and then he's got these little geysers that come up, you know, it's just spewing the water out. So
you want to be scared, be in a tractor and have a gopher hole squirt water all when you drive by. You're just going, please don't break through because I'll never see it again. And that. Well, when you were working on your 40 acres out here, that one wet year you were pulling the 4-foot cores and you pulled the core out and the water started coming out of the hole. I told him to put the plug back in.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it. Yeah, there's water out here even during dry years. It's just down there.
So Anthony has done a phenomenal job of building up his soil health to retain this amount of water, which will surely be an asset to him when the inevitable dry years come. One tool in the toolbox, though, he hasn't tapped into yet is cover crops.
I've told Dr. Wick this. I'm officially training a weed scientist. So anything in the field that's not my crop planted is a weed. I have a very difficult time with the concept of cover crop. I understand it. I just personally have a hard time because that's not what I was trained.
Well, we're not going to cropping. We're not going to push you in the field pennycress. You know, we're not going to do that.
But I mean that I do some cover cropping after wheat harvest in certain spots and things like that. I have not personally done much in crop spreading under my corn or under the sunflowers, for example. I want to try some, and I have some that I probably will try this year on soybeans, but I'm a little slow at adopting that because it's a tough concept for me to wrap my head around because of my background. Sure. You know,
your soils are so variable too. You have some that are fairly droughty as well as those that are wet, and so, you know, I don't know if you did it, it'd be, you might think about some kind of site-specific
cover crop. If I did much in a field, there would actually end up being at least two different mixes. I would have different species depending on where I'm at in the field. Yeah. You know, you'd go up on my eroded hilltops and plant more like a millet or a grass, you know, that type of deal. And then down in my lows, the heavy soils, it'd be more a turnip radish, that side of the ballgame, because I'd have two different goals. On top of the hills, I'm trying to produce organic matter. I want plant material up there. Well, the grasses tend to be more that direction than the broadleaves. And down bottom, I'm looking more for tap roots and opening soil up and that type of thing. So I haven't figured out how I would do that site-specific yet. I've barely got equipment to do one thing across the field, let alone multiples.
As I'm sure you can tell, Anthony's a fantastic example of a farmer that, even though he's been doing it for a long time, he has a master's degree, he's done research, he's been in agribusiness, he is still constantly looking for answers. He's constantly trying to tweak and refine his operation to improve and get better. So I asked him, what are the big things on his mind, the big challenges he's thinking about to take the next step in his soil health journey?
For me, my biggest challenge is I need to expand my crop choices. I currently only raise four crops, soybeans, sunflowers, wheat, and corn. And sunflowers is pretty limited because if I get too far out of my home base area, the blackbirds chew me to shreds. I got some areas I'd love to raise sunflowers on. I can't.
What do you do for the blackbirds close to home?
They don't tend to bother right here at home. 3 miles away, they chew me up. Now, the other thing I tend to do, I plant early. 12th, 10th of May is my target date on sunflowers, which I didn't hit this year, needless to say. And then I desiccate around big iron time. So then I combine my sunflowers before the soybeans. And right in this area, I don't have any local flocks, so that means I get them harvested before the migratory birds come through. That's how I deal with blackbirds.
Once you get about 2 or 3 miles away, you have those big marshy areas with all those cattails, and that's just blackbird heaven.
They don't cross the ridge a mile and a half south of here for whatever. When they do, I'm in trouble. Shotguns and planes won't keep them away, and I've had it happen twice, but that's where I've learned to desiccate and get them off so there's nothing to bait them to bring them in. If they fly through and there's no fields, they don't stay around. Well, with my sandier soils, I always looked at like field peas would be a choice, but they kind of come and gone around the area, so there's no local markets. That would be a little tough. I don't really know. That's the problem. We used to raise a lot of barley on this farm, but the marketing of the barley got to be, I love barley. I can raise 100, 120 bushel barley, no problem. I can't get rid of it. As malt. I end up dumping it as feed half the time, and there's no money in it if I do it that way. So that's why I gave up on barley and expanded more into corn. that's the problem. I haven't really figured out a crop. I've looked at dry beans. Well, I already got enough soybeans. I don't need any more legumes in my rotation. So do I really want to add dry beans to it? So that's the issue. I don't know what it would be. Sure. You know, it isn't just the production. I know I can raise some of these crops. It's the marketing and handling them that becomes the issue.
This economic piece that Anthony highlights is extremely important. There's really no point in raising a crop if it doesn't make economic sense, if there is no market for it. So it not only needs to be optimized for improving one's soil, but it just needs to make economic sense this year as well to keep the business afloat. So I asked Anthony how he evaluates when and if to try a new approach and take on a new technology.
If I can change something without doing major equipment changes, I will try things as soon as something is feasible to do it with. You know, all of that is variable. I'm not scared of new ideas and technology. I'll try anything once. Sometimes you have to try it twice because you can get a bad year. But I mean, you know, what has made a big deal, and some of that's working with NDSU and my background is, technology is what's making me money. Not necessarily equipment is, but it's more the technology in the equipment. The computer control, the variable rate, the satellite, all of that. It isn't the tires and the engine that's making me money now. It's the technology and managing. I've got one right now this year. Everybody thinks it's the smartest thing in the world and the right idea, but nobody's ever done it. I've variable rated my soil applieds based on soil texture for my soybeans. The concept is right. The product should work, but nobody's ever done it field scale, so nobody knows what'll happen. So I got a little trial about 300 acres. Okay. Farmer's Edge is the company that I work with on my precision side. They wrote the prescriptions. Actually, they were here yesterday and downloaded the as-applied maps, because the prescription and as-applied don't always match perfect. 90-foot sprayer doesn't... I can't break by zones. And they're going to look at it. And actually, Dr. Eichley has talked about he's going to come out. He wants copies of those maps, and he would like to walk the fields and just see if he can see crop injury differences, performance, and weed control. Farmer's Edge has some interns that they're going to try to document it. So we're trying to keep track of this, because if this works, it is going to change some of the weed control, because with my variable soils, I have to use lower rates for safety on my sands, and then I don't get performance in my heavy soils. Now I have the technology that I can put the high rate on where I need it and yet be a low enough rate that I'm safe on my crop in other areas. This really come from the sunflowers. The sulfentrazone, the active ingredient in Authority or Spartan, is sunflower's tolerance is marginal, and I've had to shave my rates down to get safety on the sunflowers, and I lose performance. Soybeans have a lot higher tolerance, so my experiment's in the soybeans because it's safer to play there than it is in my sunflower crop. But I mean, that's my goal, is to take it into sunflowers eventually. But I picked a crop that I have a better tolerance. If I got my rates a little too high, that crop will tolerate it a little better, you know.
About the time that Precision Ag came on, in the late 80s, Roundup came on. And so people forgot about site-specific weed control. And now that we're in the post-Roundup age, for the most part, at least, you know, many places, then you're rediscovering pre-emergence and soil-applied stuff. And so the technology is there if it'll just work. I'm glad that Joe is interested in that.
These new farm technologies are definitely game changers in a lot of ways, but they also present new challenges, such as finding good people.
Finding labor sometimes that's qualified to run things is difficult. And it's even worse for me, because everything I do is basically computer controlled. And any retired guy that said, well, I'll come and work for you, I said, well, do you run a 2630? No, I don't touch computer screens. Well, sorry. I have nothing for you to run then, because everything I get in the cab has got a computer screen, and the machine's being controlled by the computer, not you, you know. So it gets very, very difficult to find help that you can put into a cab that's willing to run some of this and spend the time.
Yeah.
First few years that we started really mapping yields, which is 18, 20 years ago, because it was when you were first started.
Around 20 years ago.
Yeah. My dad wasn't quite as careful all the time about changing field and farm and all of that. And, well, the data doesn't do you a lot of good if you don't do a good job collecting the data. He spent a lot of time calibrating. It was accurate. It just, the whole farm become one field all of a sudden. You know, things like that.
But I'll never forget when he gave me a call, because he was always pretty skeptical of the whole idea. And he calls me on the phone one day and says, Dave, you wouldn't believe the differences in yields out here. You know, I always knew that area was highest yielding, but I mean, the barley's going, you know, 130, 140, and we're going down on these swales, and gosh, it's only 20, 30 bushels or so. And you know, he just kept talking for about 10 minutes, and he was just excited, just like a kid. So that was a cool conversation. You know, most farmers have an idea, of course, that things vary across the field, but a lot of them have no idea that a lot of, you know, the range, huge range. And, you know, part of his point was, if we could just, you know, maybe we can't get 120 on that, but if we can just go from 20 to 40 and, you know, and think about what we could make. So, yeah, it was an eye-opener for him.
And that's probably what drove me more into the site-specific work, was when you saw the huge range. That's what made me start thinking, well, okay, if we got this variability, and like I said, originally the idea was we're going to bring everything up to the top numbers. Well, we found out that ain't possible. It's the other way around. But that's part of working with Dr. Franson. That's one of the things we discovered, that you go, but that's all of that. Finding this information, seeing the yield, seeing the variability is what led to, boy, can we manage this? And I have to say, so far in my experience, yes, you can.
Managing that variability is exactly what precision ag technology is all about. And I love seeing the blend here between technology and sustainability. And it all comes about because of the collaboration between people like Dr. Franson and Anthony.
Well, the great thing is that when I get a question from Anthony or a thought, you know, that's, you know, he's out there thinking about this all the time, you know, and I probably don't think about the same kind of thing. So sometimes I have ideas and I share them when we talk, and he has ideas and he shares them when we talk. It's this interaction thing. The extension in North Dakota is just amazing. I think it's the best system in the country, and there's just a lot of feedback back and forth between me and agents and farmers and me, and then me and agent. You know, it's this continual communication that we get. You know, the feedback is, you know, that all of our recommendations, all of our thoughts are not chiseled on a temple wall someday. You know, somewhere that they're. We're pretty sure that there's steps in the right direction, but we haven't reached nirvana yet.
See, he's being really forgetting about the main reason he can work on this farm. I've had soils 201. I want my resident soil scientist here all the time working. Yeah, free consultation. I don't know how many times I went and talked to him in the field while he was sampling and things like that, because he's right here.
But it's a nice break. I could use a break.
Yeah. But I laugh about it, but there's some truth to it. That soils was probably in the whole plant architecture for me, the classes, was probably my weakest point. So having a soil scientist on the farm that I got to know really well and knows my farm probably better than I do was a real advantage. So when he calls and says, I need a site, okay, where do you want it?
Big thank you to Dr. Dave Franson and Anthony Tilmoni for taking the time to share their stories and insights with us. I found not only the content interesting between soil fertility and precision agriculture, but just to get to see the dynamic between researcher and someone who works for extension and farmer putting it into practice. I think it's such a valuable story and a model that hopefully can be replicated in other parts of the country. Hey, if you're listening and appreciating this content, I have three things to ask of you. Number one, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Number two, tell a friend about it. If you know anyone who's a farmer, researcher, somebody who works in agriculture, and just interested in general and soil health, we would love for you to help us spread the word about this. And then third and finally, make sure you go to ndsoilsense.com. That's our website. So ND, just like North Dakota, ndsoilsense.com. And check out all of the content that's there. And you'll also get links to Dr. Abby Wick's website, where she has a lot more information about soil health in North Dakota. Thanks, as always, to the North Dakota Corn Council and the North Dakota Soybean Council for making all of this possible. We'll be back next week with another episode of Soil Sense. Make sure you're subscribed.